Hello, I'm Bilal Butt. This is number 0503, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0503. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet David Weitzner, author of 15 Paths, which talks about how to reclaim our world, to think, to create, and to be more democratically engaged. Why did he write the book?
As a professor, you have hope that rational discourse has a place in our society, that people are open-minded, that you can change minds. And I got to a hopeless place within that, you know, profession, saying I'm not reaching people in the way that I'm hoping to reach people. And my colleagues and I are not having the discussions that we hope to have.
Brian Skiba is the filmmaker behind the Easter holiday-themed horror film Rotten Tail.
Peter Cotton is a scientist developing a fertility serum in a secret, top-secret lab, but he's kind of the redheaded stepchild. And the guy next door is developing weapons for the army, and he's created a mutated bunny. The mutated bunny ends up biting Peter. Peter starts to change. And he ends up becoming Rotten Tail. It's his high school reunion. It just happens to be that weekend on Easter, and decides he's going to go home and pay some vengeance to the bullies that killed his pet bunny when he was a child.
Ernie Smith from Tedium is back talking about how milk crates have historically been used for so many other things other than creating milk.
They're just perfect as a receptacle. Like, they're often made of thick plastic. They're of a good size, and they're well engineered.
And there's lots and lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0503 was Bilal Butt, the afternoon drive announcer at SHOM 97.7, the Spirit of Rock, here in Montreal. Thank you very much, Bilal, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Much appreciated. A show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Now, we are just shy of two decades into the 21st century, but there are still some places that haven't quite joined us yet. Case in point, Kentucky's Governor Matt Bevin signed a new law to prohibit sex between humans and animals. It took several attempts to get the bill through the legislature. Several previous attempts failed, including because some members were concerned such a law would interfere with private property rights. Yes, really. Violations of the new law would be a felony punishable by 1 to 5 years in prison, plus a prohibition against owning any animal, living in a place where there's access to an animal, and the perpetrator must receive treatment or counseling. Other previous failed bills tried to prohibit sex with pets, but not other animals, and one proposed an exemption in the law for those engaged in animal husbandry. And no, that doesn't mean you have to marry it first. You know, it's one thing to have either antiquated laws on the books or to not have some laws that you should have merely as an oversight. But when you're trying to table laws that common sense dictates they really should be a standard slam dunk, and you're drawing opposition, doesn't that speak volumes as to problems in our society? Just think about it. It wasn't that long ago in many parts of the United States that adultery was illegal. But there were no laws on the books about heading out to the barn for a quickie. Yeah. Detroit police say they can't confirm what made an unnamed 50-year-old man shoot himself in the foot on March 19th, but rumor has it that he was aiming for something entirely different. Reports state that the man, who uses a wheelchair, was trying to kill a cockroach by throwing his shoe at it. The shoe contained his handgun, and it fell out of the shoe and discharged, striking his foot. Police say the man was in stable condition after the incident. Wow. Talk about not putting your best foot forward. I think we can now rule out shoes as a good place to hide your gun. On March 29th, in a suburb of Stockholm, Sweden, an off-duty police officer was enjoying a nice sauna when he noticed that another man in the sauna was a fugitive wanted for aggravated assault, among other things. They recognized each other, and the naked police officer calmly told the man that he should consider himself arrested. The officer called for backup, and the arrest was undramatic, according to a police spokesperson. You see how civilized an arrest can be in Sweden? No car chases, no gun battles, no hostage situation, just the naked truth. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Rogers, Arkansas neighbors Charles Eugene Ferris, who is 50, and 36-year-old Christopher Hicks were hanging out on Ferris's back porch on March 31st, drinking and enjoying the spring air. Ferris was wearing his bulletproof vest, because why not, and invited Hicks to shoot him with a .22-caliber semi-automatic rifle. The vest blocked the bullet from striking Ferris, but it still hurt and left a red mark on his upper chest. Next, Hicks donned the vest and Ferris unloaded the clip into Christopher's back, according to the police report, leaving many bruises. That's where it all should have ended, or would have ended, if Ferris had not gone to the hospital, where staff alerted the Benton County Sheriff's Office. Ferris initially told officers an elaborate story about being shot while protecting an asset in a dramatic gunfight, but Ferris's wife spilled the beans about the back porch challenge. Both men were arrested for suspicion of aggravated assault. Okay, this is simply a Darwin File starter kit story, because you know clowns like these will escalate and do something else that will remove them from the gene pool. But I do have one simple question. How does an aggravated assault charge stem from voluntary stupidity? I mean, if you're asking for it, is it really assault? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? According to David Weitzner, it's time to reclaim our world and rethink what it means to listen, to think, to create, and to be more democratically engaged citizens. He's the author of the book, 15 Paths, How to Time Out Noise, Turn On Imagination, and Find Wisdom. David joins us on the line right now via Skype from Toronto. Hi, David.
Hi, Peter.
Thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks.
It seems to be, in this day and age, a very tall order that you're asking here.
Yes. The short answer, yes. Look, it was not an easy task to really get the courage to write the book. I'm a professor, and, you know, as a professor, you have hope that rational discourse has a place in our society, that people are open-minded, that you can change minds. And I got to a hopeless place within that, you know, profession, saying I'm not reaching people in the way that I'm hoping to reach people. And my colleagues and I are not having the discussions that we hope to have. And so, born out of frustration, I went on this journey trying to figure out if there are perhaps other types of folks that should be leading our conversation. And my conclusion was we need to really emphasize imagination at this point in our history, over rationality, not to embrace the realm of irrational, but it's just that we're not convincing each other. We're not having conversations. We're yelling at each other in silos, and we're not bringing folks on side. And so, tall order, yes. Necessary task, also yes.
Okay, as a professor, I'm sure this is something you've discussed with colleagues. Was there in any estimation of either yourself or your colleagues as to when things took a turn, or has it always been this seed of discourse growing for a long time?
So I'm going to cynically respond. This is my own opinion, not born of conversation with my colleagues, but I actually blame my generation because I felt like when I was an undergraduate student, we were having good conversations across ideological lines. I was exposed to a lot of professors who I fundamentally disagreed with, both from a lifestyle perspective, from a politics perspective, and we got along and we chatted and we were able to respect each other. And I feel that since my generation have become the professors, we've sort of changed our approach and we're not really carrying on the tradition that many of us were educated in. Now, to a certain extent, that can be a good thing because there was institutional sexism and racism within academia, and I'm glad to see pushbacks against that. But at the same time, we're not conversing with each other, and I think it's new to my generation of leadership. Maybe I'm wrong, but I certainly didn't feel like this as a student. And I'm certainly feeling like this now on the other side of the table.
And to quantify this, which generation do you represent?
Okay, so I'm in my, I was doing my university education during the 90s. So I would represent, I think we were technically on the tail end of Generation Xers. But more importantly, I'll say that throughout the 90s, I still found on-campus discourse to work across ideologies, across political divides, and I don't think that that's true today.
Do you think that part of the problem has been the boom, the advent of technology, of individual technology, that to a certain degree brings us closer together but also pulls us apart?
I do. I'm a big fan of Doug Rushkoff. You know, Doug Rushkoff was a guy who was one of the first to embrace, internet and online technology as a possibility to better our human exchanges. He's the guy who coined the phrase going viral. And he himself has now taken a critical turn. And one of the ideas that he shares in his work, which I think, you know, really resonates with me, is noting that we shouldn't adopt to machine time and style. We need to retain our humanity and use the tools in a way that works for us. And I think that's a really important idea. I'm not going to blame the tool, but I'm going to blame the way we use the tool. And so, you know, he gives the example of, you know, in the early days, we privileged email for communication. And email allows us to think, right? You'd send out a message, you'd think about what you'd write, you'd wait for a response, you'd read that response slowly and carefully and wait to form your own response, right? You use the tool, but in human time. Now with Twitter and hot takes and instant messaging, we're running on machine time, but our brains still need to operate on human time. And so we're using the tool in a way that doesn't maximize our own potential and work to our own benefits.
Okay, so I'm actually a generation older than you, okay? I'm a late-end baby boomer. And I'm wondering if you, as a professor, you have all the tools, the analytical tools to think this thing through. Have you given any thought to the idea that as you say, it is generational, but generational from an older man, get off my lawn type of situation?
That's why I was very careful to not agree with blaming the generation who are on the other side of it. In other words, I'm blaming my generation who are, you know, the associate professors right now, who are taking over departments right now, who are creating the curriculum right now. And I don't blame the millennial generation who are perhaps not being taught appropriately how to deal with life and thinking and whatnot in general. So I'm not prepared to be the old man waving my hand at the millennial saying, you're the problem. I'm actually blaming my own generation for saying, as we begin to take power, we're bringing in a lot of changes. And some of those changes are good. As I noted before, you know, the university is a lot more diverse now. That's a good thing. There are a lot more folks with, you know, different backgrounds, different orientations, different genders. That's all a good thing. But if we're not having conversation, that's a problem. And I can't blame the millennial who was never given a safe space to have a conversation, but I can blame us who have a classroom, who have that power, and who are not creating an environment that allows for the same sort of exchange of ideas that we were privileged to have when we were trained. So I'm not going to be the old man waving his fist. I will blame my own generation before I blame the next generation.
And the reason why I bring up generations is because when technology is used generationally, we look at it, we being older, sometimes we adapt to the technology that is brought forth.
Right.
We enjoy the generation that the technology rather that is brought forth, but we might use it differently than the right. generation behind us
right.
that doesn't necessarily see a problem that we see.
Yes. And I agree with that. And that's one of the tough things, you know, being a parent right now, right, is I obviously have my biases around screen time. And, you know, if it were up to me, my kids would have no access to screens. But I recognize that that could be a bias based on my generation and where I come from. And so then it really becomes about helping my child find that balance. One of the things I write about in my book is that I can't fathom what it means for a child to grow up without the din of parental conversation. I understand that texting might be a more comfortable method of communicating for them. So even though I can't relate, I can understand why my child might rather text his or her friends rather than pick up a phone and call them and speak to them. I can learn about that. But the notion of retreating to a digital space constantly and, let's say, not being present at a dinner table and not being part of familial conversation in real time in person, if that's an old man thing, then in that sense, I'm prepared to be the old man waving his fist, because I do think that it's important to create boundaries. And so to say, you know, dinner table, we have to converse. We have to look at each other in the eye. We have to engage face to face. And even if that's not natural to you, I think your development will be best served by adopting my frame. At the same time, I'm not going to say to my kid, why aren't you talking on the phone more and texting less? Because perhaps, as you've noted, this is better for them and will lead to better relationships for them. I don't know that. The jury's out on that. I don't have the data. I do have the data, though, to suggest that, you know, if we don't spend time together cross-generationally, and if we don't look each other in the eye and don't come together at a table and don't interact in person, that will hamper their social development.
Your book is called 15 Paths. What does the title mean?
So there are 15 paths in the book. I offer 15 paths, pieces of advice to try and reclaim our social conversation, to redirect it. 14 of the paths are with 14 individual artists that I had found inspirational and who I spoke to and who together through our conversation we come up with an overall recommendation. And then the 15th path is my own. So readers would encounter 15 ideas, recommendations for how to improve their life, and 14 individual artists as well as myself.
And when you mention readers, who were you going after as a reader when you first came up with the idea for this book? Who was your target audience?
Anyone who shares my frustration and who wants to open their mind to the possibility of refining their imaginative faculties. The idea behind the book was that, you know, conversations aren't happening in the way that they should, and rational discourse has sort of reached its limit. And so I spoke to the people that inspired me, but I spoke to them because they're all individuals who have refined their imaginative ability. And so even if you're not into rock and roll or hip hop or any of the genres in which the artists that I spoke to create their art in, I think there's still something for you to gather, to gain, to learn from the conversations themselves. So really, the book is designed to reach everyone and anyone. It's written very accessibly. I thank my editors for trying to really beat out the academic in me. And so we were very deliberate in trying to capture conversation in its natural form and have books and ideas that are accessible to everybody.
And you said you have kids. Have your kids read the book?
My kids have read the book, and my kids are mentioned in the book, and it's quite nice to be able to give that to them.
And their thoughts on the book?
They love it. They're young. They're very proud to see their dad engage in something like this. And it certainly has stimulated their own thinking about possibility. I think they like the idea that their dad has stepped out of his box so completely. And they like the idea that their dad has been very honest in this book. And I think it has served a purpose, even with them, in opening them up to conversation with their parents about the ideas. Like the ideas that you mentioned earlier, you know, they read about my view on social media and my view on parenting, and we were able to have an open conversation about where we might disagree and where we might agree on this topic.
And I'm sure it adds to more dinner time conversations, which is what you wanted in the first place.
It sure does.
David, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Peter.
David Weitzner, author of 15 Paths, How to Time Out Noise, Turn on Imagination, and Find Wisdom. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, turn to the page for this show, which is show number 0503, and you'll find links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the film Rotten Tale, plus Ernie Smith from Tedium talks about milk crates. And we also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, plus much more in Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. If the New Jersey firefighter who rigged a firehouse toilet seat with firecrackers expected his victim to say, "You nearly blew off one of my testicles. Ha! That was a good one," then he was sorely mistaken. Firefighter Thomas Wengerder admitted to placing firecrackers under the toilet seat as a prank, but when Raymond John sat on the John, he wasn't amused. John said he heard and felt an explosion beneath him. Afterward, he discovered he was bleeding from the left side of his scrotum and a blood blister had formed. Later, Wengerder denied he was the one who placed the firecracker on the toilet, but that didn't stop Johns from suing him for the injuries he suffered. His complaint was dismissed when a trial judge ruled that Johns couldn't sue his fellow firefighter over the incident because the injury was covered under the Workers' Compensation Act. You know, it's always that one firefighter who likes to light things on fire. And, okay, never mind the idea of a lawsuit. How come the perpetrator isn't up on criminal charges? Just asking. Police in New Hampshire say they cited a driver who had a kid in her lap, the baby goat kind. Marlboro police said they pulled the woman over on April Fool's Day when they saw her using a cell phone. They soon realized that she was driving without a valid license and with a goat. Police said the driver was a 60-year-old woman from Sullivan, New Hampshire. She was released on a citation for operating without a valid license. She also was counseled about distracted driving. Police posted the encounter on Facebook with the comment, "I wish this was another April Fool's joke, but it's not." You know, they could have just simply said, "No kidding." So, she had no license, was talking on the phone, and had a goat in her lap. Talk about the trifecta.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
This is an important self-serving promotional bulletin. My book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So, buy the book. What are you waiting for? This has been an important self-serving promotional bulletin.
I love you. Now, back to our show.
Authorities say an armed robber was foiled at a Madison, Wisconsin convenience store when he cut the clerk's finger and her blood made it impossible to open the cash drawer with the register's computer screen. The robbery occurred at around 9:25 p.m. at a 7-Eleven. Police say a masked suspect was armed with a box cutter and sliced the woman's finger when he charged at her. Police say the cash drawer is controlled by a computer touchscreen that does not function when wet. The robber instead grabbed some cigarettes and fled to a getaway car. Well, you can't get blood from a stone or, apparently, a cash register. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Weber County, Utah mother who prosecutors say served alcohol and performed lap dances for teenagers at her house during a birthday party is facing a dozen criminal charges. 40-year-old Rihanna Renee Nivens of Harrisville was charged with four counts of dealing in harmful materials to a minor, a third-degree felony, four counts of lewdness, a Class B misdemeanor, and four counts of contributing to the delinquency of a minor, a Class B misdemeanor. On February 9th, a birthday party was held at Nivens' home. 12 teens between 14 and 17 years old attended. During this party, the minors drank alcohol and smoked marijuana, and Nivens knew about this occurring in her home and even drank some alcohol with them, according to the charges. Nivens then went upstairs to change into a risque outfit, which the charging documents described as red and black lingerie. The minors stated that after Nivens came back downstairs in the lingerie, she began to dance sexually for approximately 10 minutes, during which time she gave several minors lap dances. At least one teen recorded some of the alleged lap dancing on a cell phone. Harris police were contacted the next day. Well, cuckoo ka-choo, Mrs. Robinson. I'm sure this was a birthday that her son would like to forget and his friends will remember for the rest of their lives. Anyway, let's get to the next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Award-winning filmmaker Brian Skiba has a new Easter-themed comedic horror flick that's just about to come out. It's called Rotten Tail, based on the graphic novel of the same name. Brian joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles to talk about the film. Hi, Brian.
Hello. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Now, in addition to this movie, Rotten Tail, a comedic horror flick, you are also the man behind Defending Santa, correct?
I am. That is me.
What went wrong in your childhood?
I enjoy Christmas movies as much as I do a good grindhouse bloodfest. So, you know, it's I guess a duality of personality, I guess is what you could call it. I don't know.
So tell us about Rotten Tail, then, the plot of the film. It's a rather unique story.
It is very. The basis of the story is classic. I mean, it's the Spider-Man. You know, it's a it's that kind of idea where Peter Cotton is a scientist that's developing a fertility serum in a secret top secret lab, but he's kind of the redheaded stepchild, and the guy next door is developing weapons for the army, and he's created a mutated bunny, and the mutated bunny ends up biting Peter, and Peter starts to change. And he ends up becoming Rotten Tail, and then decides that it's his high school reunion. It just happens to be that weekend on Easter, and decides he's going to go home and pay some vengeance to the bullies that killed his pet bunny when he was a child. So, and from there the hilarity and blood flows. So,
and it does take place at a reunion. I don't know how you feel about reunions, but I've always felt that. A reunion is only a place where people get together to see who's fallen apart.
True. It is true. Recently one of my reunions, I won't say which one, I don't want to date myself, but, it's definitely, that's the case. You walk in and everybody's looking for the guy that's the mess and the guy that's the success. And, So Rotten Tail walks in and just says, you know, screw all you guys. You guys killed my pet bunny, so you're all going down. So
As I mentioned, the film is a comedic horror flick. So how do you balance, as a director, the comedy with the horror?
I grew up on that. My dad was a big, he liked B movies, and that's what we watched. We watched, and we would sit there and laugh, you know, his favorite movie was Big Trouble in Little China, you know, which is, you know, over the top kind of, John Carpenter kind of thing. And so that's what I grew up on. And so when I'm on set, and especially with David Hayes, who's kind of the same breed, and, you know, we wrote this thing together, and when I'm on set and a moment presents itself, hilarity ensues. And not only that, but it has to do with casting as well. I fight for my cast, and I get people like Cora Nemec and William McNamara who have this kind of straight comedic edge that they can lend to the film. And so we just find the funny in the horrific, you know.
Tell us more about the cast. You already mentioned two of the stars in the film. How did you go about finding the cast for this movie?
Well, initially, when I was approached on the project, I only had one condition, which was I wanted the Rotten Tail outfit and mask and everything to be top notch, you know. And then when I started auditioning people, it changed into I need a second condition, which is I need a good actor as Rotten Tail. The other actors I had worked with before, you know, Gianni Capaldi, Dominique Swain, Billy McNamara, we had all worked together on multiple films, and they were friends of mine. But Cora and I had only met a couple of times, just, you know, schmoozing around LA. But I familiar with his work, and I was talking to the casting director, Ricky Masler, and I mentioned Cora to her, was like, hey, I after auditioning 200 gentlemen, that actors that were decent, but none of them had the soul. And that's what I was looking for, because Rotten Tail is a very specific soul. We approached Corin, and he had already heard of the project. He had already heard about Rotten Tail, read the graphic novel, and was on board and just excited, and actually came in and gave a few notes on the script, and we worked together, and really it became a collaboration between he and I to develop that character. I appreciate his work, because his commitment level is outstanding.
Well, you mentioned you went through 200 auditions before you found the right actor for the movie. Was there a point where you said to yourself, when it came to finally choosing Corin, was there an aha moment where you said, oh, I know the direction we were going on, and, you know, we spent some time doing this with 200 people, but I know where I want to go now?
There was definitely that moment. And it came when we did the makeup test. So I brought Corin in, and I wasn't 100% sure, but the minute we put the mask on him and the teeth in and he started walking around, it was like, yeah, this is our guy. This is 100%. You know, we did a chemistry test with a few other actors, who were good, but the chemistry just wasn't right. Dominique was a better fit. But Corin's sensibility and his overall just acting abilities brought that character to life. And the minute we got done with the makeup test, the producers and I were like, yeah, this is our guy, 100%. Yeah. And
as you said, you grew up with your dad watching a horror flicks and laughing hysterically at it with your dad. Was that the genesis, not only for being a fan of horror, but also deciding that you wanted to be a filmmaker yourself?
I think so. One of my earliest memories was my uncle had stolen a 35mm print of Star Wars and brought it to our house and somehow projected it. I mean, of course, I was three, so I have no idea what they did. But all I remember is they were super excited because they had this, you know, stolen copy, and it was the 70s, and I remember watching it and seeing Darth Vader as, you know, I think I was three or four or five, maybe, I don't know, and that was really the genesis. And then Saturday afternoon, there was these, action theater and things like that. My where I lived in a small town, and we only got three channels. And in the afternoon, there would always be this action theater, and I'd sit there and watch all three movies that were, it was kind of like a triple feature of just bad B movies. And, bad in a good way, just fun, either, karate or horror or sci-fi. And it's just something I really grew to love. And, I do a lot of TV, and that's more like the business side of me. And then Rotten Tail is more like letting my hair down. And that's the rock star, what I love, what I want to watch. And, hopefully keep doing.
I'm just deeply concerned that the statute of limitations have run out on your uncle's crime, because you know what Disney can be like.
I hope it's run out. He got it legally. Erase everything I just said.
So. The movie comes out in cinemas on April the 12th. You must be pretty excited to have the premiere of this movie and the potential fan reaction for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We did a, we've had multiple cuts of this film, and we did a, an audience preview, with cards and input. And it was super helpful to find which jokes were working, which jokes weren't. The cut went from about a 110 minute cut down to about a 94, 95 minute cut is where it's at right now. And the audience response has from people who have seen it so far, it's one of those films you either really get, you grew up in the 80s, you watch it, and you're like, yeah, I remember this. I remember watching this on Channel 10, and the antenna was all messed up, but you still watch just because there's nothing else on. Are you going to appreciate it as an art piece? Because really, you can't. We had to create everything, all the looks, anything on there is, that's obviously not in camera. That's everything's created. And our intention was to make it look like this is a 1980s, early 80s, horror comedy. But in actuality, a straight horror, but we had, the comedic elements play because, it's campy. And so I expect audiences to laugh and enjoy it. And then there's going to be those few that definitely get offended, I'm sure. So, to each his own, and it's art. So you look at it and get your own interpretation.
Well, if you're not offending someone, you're not working hard enough.
That's the truth. That is the truth.
Congratulations on the film Rotten Tail. It comes out on April the 12th. I thank you very much for being on the program with us, Brian.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Filmmaker Brian Skiba. His film is Rotten Tail, which hits theaters on April 12th. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0503, and you'll find links to Brian's site and also the Rotten Tail trailer. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Who would ever think that a lawsuit involving ice cream could give us a lesson on why filing a lawsuit isn't always such a good idea? But it did, and here's the story. In the 1960s, a premium ice cream maker developed a unique marketing theme based on its Scandinavian-sounding name. 2 decades later, when another ice cream maker also started doing business under a Scandinavian name, the first company sued to force it to change its name. When the case finally made it to court, however, the New York-based creators of the first Scandinavian-sounding company admitted that their own name was actually made up and had no meaning in any language. Meanwhile, even though the second company was also based in the United States, its name was taken from a real Swedish phrase meaning frozen joy. Let's be fair, after these marketing secrets were revealed in court, the judge quickly put a deep freeze on the lawsuit. He said that since the first company didn't even have a real connection to Scandinavia, the lawsuit had no merit. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about milk crates. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. And more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, Memphis police say that they have arrested a man after he made a false report about a carjacking. Officers arrived on the scene at 11 a.m. The victim, Joshua Scott, told officers that he was struck in the face and his 2011 Nissan Sentra was stolen. A few days later, on April 2nd, investigators met up with Scott again to discuss the investigation. After Scott provided another statement, investigators determined that there were some inconsistencies. They confronted Scott with evidence and determined the report was fabricated. Scott then admitted that he reported the carjacking to cover up the fact that he had given his vehicle to a friend in exchange for meth. He has been charged with false reporting. What I'd like to know is how he was only charged with false reporting. Surely there must be a meth charge somewhere in his future. Yeah. And before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, one more story. And after seeing this next story, I'm beginning to think that crime might be an addiction. Casey Michael Lewis was a free man for about 15 minutes, not even leaving the grounds of the jail where he had been locked up before being arrested again. The 37-year-old had just been released from the St. Lucie County Detention Facility in Fort Pierce, Florida, where he had been held on grand theft charges. After he was released, Lewis then began walking around the jail's parking lot, acting suspicious and checking vehicle doors. Surveillance video showed Lewis looking into cars and opening the door of a silver vehicle. Lewis allegedly entered the vehicle from the driver's side and sat in the car for about 2.5 minutes. He then exited the vehicle and walked around the length of the lot, checking vehicles along the way by either looking into the windows or lifting door handles to see whether they were unsecured. While Lewis was in the parking lot, he was approached by an officer. He told the officer he was waiting for his girlfriend. The arresting officer said that when Lewis was approached, questioned, and finally arrested, he gave the officer a brown paper bag with items from a vehicle. The items included an iPhone 7, 4 packs of cigarettes, a lighter, 1 Visa bank debit card, a Florida driver's license, and $547 in cash. Lewis was arrested on charges of burglary, grand larceny, and possession of stolen property, and taken back inside the jail. Boy, if you look up the word habitual in the dictionary, you're going to see this guy's picture. Anyway, on to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Ernie Smith, the man behind the website and newsletter known as Tedium, which is subtitled The Dull Side of the Internet, is back. This time around, he's here to talk about a recent newsletter that took a look at the theft that most of us in our youth perpetrated. I'm talking about the thousands of milk crates that we've used for record storage, among other things. Ernie joins us on the line via Skype from Virginia. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, how's it going?
Just tickety-boo. And this particular newsletter item was one that was near and dear to my heart, and I immediately closed all the blinds in my house to make sure someone's watching, because I do have milk crates like so many other people do on this planet, because they're so good at collecting things in.
Yeah, they're just perfect as a receptacle. Like, they're often made of thick plastic, they're of a good size, and they're well engineered.
Now, one of the things, and I don't know if you mentioned this in your newsletter, but I was doing some research on my own and found out the reason why everyone's so hot and heavy and going after those who steal these things is because while most of us take crates to use for our own purposes, there actually is a large crime unit out there that goes after this. I understand the International Dairy Foods Association states that 20 million a year vanish from theft at a cost of $4 per, or that's $80 million. Now, admittedly, only 5% of those are for people like us who take them for personal use. The rest are people who are taking them for the recycling properties of the plastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely high quality plastic, and I think that makes it very attractive
for purposes of theft in the black market. They rely on high density polyethylene, which is very, you know, which is very decent quality plastic, and it goes for quite a bit. As I pointed out in the newsletter, one estimate for its cost per pound in U.S. dollars is 33 cents for every pound of this high quality plastic. And because so many of these crates are made and can be easily acquired if you know where to look, it becomes a situation where, you know, it's kind of a great way to take advantage of sort of the ever-increasing need for plastic in our society.
Now, you wrote this article, admit it. Do you have milk crates at home?
I do not, actually. I've been very thoughtful about the amount of stuff that I carry with me. I think I've become more of a collector now that, like, I feel like I'm a little bit more stable in my life and such. But I will admit, you know, there was probably a time during my dorm room days where I probably had quite a few plastic milk crates lying around. I will point out that when I was in college, though, I think it was really trendy to actually buy, like, milk crates and stuff like that, like things that look kind of like the actual milk crates from places like Target, for example.
Yeah, they now sell these things that look like what the milk crates we knew growing up, but obviously they're designed for whatever people want to tote in them. Again, the best thing, and I, you know, worked in radio all my life, and before that, of course, college radio, it was a great place to store LPs because it was the perfect size.
Yeah, it seems like a happy accident, really, because, you know, it just so happens that the 12-inch size of your average LP, it works out really dimensionally to the size that works well for a lot of milk containers. You can generally fit in about 4-gallon containers of milk, and, you know, it kind of breaks down from there as you get smaller. But, like, it's a really versatile size for the purpose of storage. And, yeah, I think that one thing that's really interesting is I've kind of heard rumblings that, you know, in some markets, they actually shrunk down the size of the containers at some point so that they would be less friendly to records.
It was actually a dual purpose here in Canada. I mean, that was one of the things that happened here, but it was also part of the fact that we went to the metric system, which changed the size of the containers.
Yeah, that's, I think it's really interesting just to consider, like, how the dimensions, you know, it's sort of like here in the U.S., it just sort of seems like we kind of stuck to these measurements and seems to have been no perception on the part of the dairy industry that these are perfect for so many other things.
In doing your deep dive to come up with the story, what were the interesting things you found out about milk crates?
Well, you know, one of the most interesting things I found is that obviously the dairy industry is really big, you know, especially, you know, in the U.S. Like, there are a number of trade associations that are involved with it, and on top of that, there's a very prominent checkoff program. And, you know, I've written a lot about checkoff programs in the past. Like, the beef industry has one that allows it to, you know, come up with new cuts of beef, for example. And, you know, one of the things that I think is really interesting about this is, as a result of all of these groups, it's kind of created a situation where some states, not every state, but a lot of notable examples, specifically Pennsylvania was the first, and Virginia, Florida, a couple others that came up with actual bans with punishments attached to them to deter people from actually using milk crates from the milk industry.
I see in your article one such notice: unauthorized use of milk cases, illegal, fine of $300 or imprisonment up to 90 days. Pennsylvania Law Act Number 37, 1987.
It's pretty wild. but, you know, it's interesting because one of the things I actually point out in the piece, this seems to be particularly isolated to Florida. There may be other examples elsewhere, but it seems to be Florida in particular might be more seeing this more than other states. But there seems to be a situation where people, you know, who have milk crates are facing, like, incidents where they basically are getting arrested because they have a milk crate, and it seems like it's just kind of an excuse to arrest them, really. Like, basically, if it wasn't them having the milk crate, it would probably be something else, you know? The Miami New Times pointed out that in a three-year period, 49 people in the Miami area went to jail because they had dairy cases, and another 58 people went to jail because they had shopping carts.
Were they in prison next to the people who tore off the labels from the side of their mattress?
Man, I certainly hope not. You know, that would be too ironic for all of us.
Also, you would find Elliot from E.T. in there, too, because if you remember, he used it as a basket for his bike.
Yeah, that's the really fascinating thing. It's just like, you know, there are a lot of examples in popular culture of these milk crates just being used everywhere. You know, obviously, Elliot, like, using it in the most iconic scene of E.T., you know, with E.T. sitting in the basket, like, it's so tied to our culture these days. And I sort of wonder near the end of the piece, like, if it, you know, if the milk industry should have played it a little bit differently. It seems like they could have used these as a promotional tool more often than kind of a target for scrutiny or an attempt to, you know, basically play the heavy.
Well, I guess the reason why they were concerned, it's like having water cascading into your house. You kind of forget of the fact that your faucet is dripping when you have a hole in your roof and the rain is coming in. And I think that maybe that's what's happening to the dairy industry. Like I said, in those figures I mentioned earlier, only 5% of the loss is for personal use. But still, it's part of a problem where they're losing $80 million.
Yeah, and I think that it's kind of a situation where the average person, somebody who's going to use a milk crate for holding a record collection, like, that's clearly a lot different from somebody who is trying to make a lot of recycled plastic to sell to manufacturers. It's kind of a situation where the law hasn't caught up with the dichotomy, I guess you could say.
But it's always interesting reading when you find something like this on Tedium, and that's why I wanted to talk to you, because it was another great article. Ernie, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ernie Smith, writer of the website and newsletter Tedium. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0503, and you'll find links to Ernie's site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We've got a few more Stuff File news stories, actually one more that I want to share with you, and of course, the moment you've all been waiting for. That comes up a little later on. First story up. Police in southern Poland say they are investigating four English-speaking tourists spotted last week in the historic city of Krakow wearing only mankinis. The four men were caught on CCTV and by an Associated Press photographer as they walked in the picturesque Renaissance Market Square and got into a horse cab. They were wearing lime green mankinis as worn by Borat, the fictional Kazakh alter ego of comic actor Sacha Baron Cohen. Krakow Provincial Police spokesman Sebastian Glenn said police are investigating the indecent antics. If convicted, the men could face up to 30 days in custody or fines of $1,300 each. Glenn said that foreign tourists, especially British ones, who come for stag parties, sometimes cause disturbance in the historic city, especially after drinking alcohol. Well, I guess we know how police in Poland feel about Brexit. You know, I think the police spokesman blaming this on alcohol is a little over the top. I mean, alcohol is something that leads to spontaneous situations. Four guys who happen to have mankinis is not impulsive. There is some premeditation and thought that went into this. And by the way, wearing a mankini in a horse cab at this time of the year has got to be a tad chilly. Yeah. Anyway, boys and girls, it's the moment we've all been waiting for. At least you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Or Orange County, Florida deputies arrested a 47-year-old man after he pointed a laser at a sheriff's office helicopter. Roger Dean Smith, wearing only boxer shorts, was caught on video pointing a laser three times from his home at the helicopter. Smith denied pointing the laser, but a sweep of his home turned up a laser pointer as well as 12 unspecified firearms and hundreds of rounds of ammunition. Deputies said Smith is a felon and is prohibited from having firearms. Smith is facing 12 counts of possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, assault on a law enforcement officer, and pointing a laser at a driver or a pilot. Now, why, oh why, would you, a convicted felon, draw attention to yourself by running outside in your boxer shorts and flashing a laser pointer at a police helicopter, no less, when you must know this would bring you unwanted attention at your home, which is filled with illegal firearms? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0503. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0503. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCore in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.